All right, welcome to the History of Dessert podcast for History W300, Global History of Food. I will be your host, Eli McCoy. Today I'm joined by Katie, Nina,
Hello.
and Cheyenne,
Hey.
good friends of mine. So to give everyone an overview and an outline of what we're going to do today, I'm going to start the podcast with a short and sweet history of dessert. Sweet. I'm going to tell you that, and I'm going to highlight how sugar was a status symbol for people back in the day. After that, I'm going to dive into three different types of desserts: donuts, churros, and homemade ice cream. But in lieu of the history of homemade ice cream, I'm going to go over an interview I did with my great grandma about homemade ice cream and about the desserts she had during the Great Depression. If anybody feels like they have something to say during the podcast, they're welcome to. They'll stop me and we'll just make this as normal of a conversation as possible. All right, to start, history of dessert. The history of dessert was actually pretty surprising to me. I'd always assumed dessert came from those, Victorian era large dinners where everybody had like a certain utensil that needed a certain thing. But that wasn't the case. I went to Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert by Michael Crandall, for my background in desserts history. And I found that around the 16th century in Italy, sugar was still a really big status symbol. So the families that, like the rich families that could afford sugar, they wouldn't even be using it for like sweet desserts. They would have like sculptures made out of sugar set on their tables. And it was just kind of like a flex. They would put it in like weird food items like stews just to be like, yeah, I can afford sugar and I can put it in here. At the end of these meals, they would put out this big pie, but it wasn't like a pie you would eat. They would just fill it with jewelry. Like a lot of that was like a lot of their era was literally just like, yeah, I've got wealth, like just flexing it on all these peasants, There were still items like sugary cakes, like pastries, but they weren't served at the end of the meal. They were served in between items like meats and vegetables. So like basically, like the way they used to do meals was all the food would come out at once. And where you see that transition over to the meals coming like one at a time, and where you really see the dessert happens in France, also around the 1600s. This new popular service was known as service à la russe, and that's the more modern practice of serving dishes one at a time. This offered that natural pre like the natural progression to a final meal, and it was usually like a small pastry, like an eclair or something, with a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. And that transition really coincides with the price and the popularity of sugar. So sugar is really interesting because around like 1000 AD is when we start seeing sucrose, or the sugar that comes from cane sugar, like the whatever that plant's called,
Yeah,
sugar
sure.
cane. But by 1900, sugar was supplying one fifth of all the calories for people in England. So it's weird that you see that transition from basically nobody having it to it becoming a staple of almost every meal. And that happened because industrial refinement of sugar really started to expand once we found the New World. So once more and more people were working on sugarcane, making sucrose, sugar's price dropped a lot. And it so did its like status symbol with rich families. More and more people were like, oh, sugar's not something that's like, if I have it, I'm rich now. It's like now everybody can afford it. Michael Crandall, the author of that book, he really accredits desserts history coming through small salons, like little tea shops where people would meet up and have tea. And he really credits it to like these chefs because they would work on like one person meals that were really sweet to go at the end of the meal. The French word desservir, which means to clear the table, popped up around the 16th century, and that's where the word dessert comes from. And by the late 1700s, pretty much all other countries had adopted the word dessert and had recognized it as a course of its own that came at the end of the meal. So that's most of the history of dessert, how it came about.
Question.
Let's hear it.
So how did France then become like the place that I guess gave all the influence to all the other countries that then adopted the word dessert? Was it just, do you know anything about that?
Like, why did the word dessert come from the French?
No, like, how did everyone just start adopting to use that word, or like?
So dessert came from the word, right?
Yeah.
But once these like chefs and these salons started using it, and all these people started spreading it, it would just, so it went to like England, it went to all these other countries, and they were like, what's dessert? And it's like, oh, it's what you eat at the end of the meal. And so they just kind of adopted it into their, you know, what they were talking about. Yeah.
So is sugar only like a European delicacy, or like did other continents also see sugar as like something only for like the rich?
Like as a status symbol?
Yeah.
Up until like the 1900s, it was a status symbol to have sugar. It was like a big deal to have it because it was so hard to come by, especially like refined sugar. So things like honey or just like chewing on the sugar cane, people have always been attracted to sweet things, but it was the actual refinement that brought it from, you know, something that anybody could obtain to something that only rich people could obtain. And it was just the fact that so few people knew how to do that and so few people were doing it. That's what made it so expensive and what made it such a popularity thing.
And then like because I know like sugar cane, there's a lot of like slavery that went into like harvesting that, and that was probably a big part of why the cost went down.
I had a question.
Yeah.
So going back to when you said that they would like bake jewelry in their pie, like why a pie? Like what symbolism do you think that holds?
Why the pie?
Yeah, like why
is that significant? So it wasn't like your traditional like little pie. Mm-hmm. It would be like a foot in diameter, like a pizza almost, and it would be large like pastry covering that just didn't taste good, and you would break it open and there would be jewels and stuff inside of it. And I don't really know why they were doing that. Like I thought it was weird. I didn't really like look into it.
It was more like a decor thing, like people came over like, oh, you have a pie for your jewelry.
Like the same with like the sculptures made out of sugar. Like they didn't even know what to do with it, so they were just like buying it and having people build stuff with it. So it really was just like because like these old dinners used to be like big affairs, more like multiple families would be there, royalty would be there. So it was more of like a, I guess, a flex, really, just like showing how hard they can go.
That's interesting. They don't have to do with that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So we're gonna transition to the history of the donut. The donut's history is pretty convoluted. People don't really know where it came from. Because archaeologists have found fossilized bits in Native American like settlings that could have been donuts. Like we just don't know. But a lot of people think it came to America from the Dutch under the name, I'm going to butcher this, it's like Olykoeks or something like that. Olykoeks, Olykoeks. I'm not going to say that. And it translates to oily cakes. But they didn't really become popular in America until World War One, because when we were over in France in World War One, we were just sending hella donuts to these people, like especially the people in the trenches. And then once these guys got back from World War One, they were like, man, we want donuts. And so around the 1920s, the first donut machine was invented by Adolf Levitt. And so the way he like had the donut machine going, and it was like you could see everything. And that was a really big appeal to people. Like you could see the donut being stretched. You could see it get fried, put on the line, have the icing and stuff put on. And people loved that. It became, I think it was called like the dessert of the progression or something, like the progression era. Just like when we were getting out of the war, they were really popular. So before, when a donut was just something that a few people had tried, now they were like less than a nickel. Everybody could get one. Everybody was eating donuts. And the donut business expands over all America, and their popularity just grew. So that's mostly the history of donuts. But in the 1970s in California, there was a lot of refugees coming from Cambodia because they had some type of war going on there. And there was this guy, Ted Nui, and he's really credited as like the father of this Cambodian donut thing. Because he went and got donuts one day, and he liked them. So the next day, he went and tried to buy a donut shop. And they were like, no, you don't know how to run a donut shop. And so he went to another donut shop, and they trained him for like a year. And he bought his first donut shop in the 70s. And then by like the mid 1980s, he owned more than 50 donut shops across the five county, like Los Angeles area. And his big thing was he would sell his donut shops to more recent Cambodian arrivals. So all these refugees that are showing up that need money, don't have really a good way to make capital or get into the economy besides like low paying jobs. Ted Nguyen was selling them these donut shops and giving them a way to survive. And the donut shop is so popular because it's so like viable to the economy. It's a low cost of operation. You don't need a lot of work. They're easy to make and they're already very popular. Like people love donuts. Like I still buy donuts now, right? And then just the sense of community that the Cambodians like built. They had this thing called a tong time. It shows up in other cultures, in Mexican culture and Spanish culture. And it's basically a small group of them from anywhere between like 6 to 30 people would work together and they would buy everybody a donut shop. So they would all like they'd draw lottery or like draw bids. And then, so this is the first person, we're all gonna pool our resources together and buy him a donut shop, right? And then he would wait until the next one was available, was they had enough money, and he would put in money to buy the next person a donut shop until they all had donut shops. And really by the mid 90s, there were 2,000 Cambodian owned donut shops in California. It's like, it's specifically the Los Angeles counties, like the five counties that Los Angeles is in. So it really helped them accomplish their own American dream and build together. Interesting connections there. Like you don't see Americans doing that.
No, it's really cool that they like were buying each other like donut shops, like whole donut shops, just to
Yeah, I'm definitely a donut advocate.
Yeah.
All right, on to the next, the history of the churro. I'm doing a brief history of the churro because I wanted to tie it back to Mexico with the in-class reading. I think it's called Mexico's Way Out. But anyways, the churro brings forth the vision of a large breadstick looking item covered in sugar, sometimes filled with something sweet, but they did not originate in Mexico like most people think. Where they originated is debated amongst historians, but it's commonly believed that they came from China, because the original Chinese churro was called a yutiao. And there were these Portuguese explorers that brought it back to Iberia. And that's where it gets its like the star edged shape, because that's what Spain did with it. They put like that, you know how churros look, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what Spain did to change it up. But it was the conquistadors that introduced it to Latin America. And it's undergone changes in Mexican culture. It's like the Mexican churro is not the same as a Spanish churro, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It became a staple of Mexican street food. And it's likely that many Americans assume churros come from Mexico just because it is so popular there. The reason I wanted to get into Mexican desserts and focus on the churro specifically is because in the 1930s in Mexico, they were going through a famine. They were unable to produce the necessary foodstuffs for their growing population, especially in their main cities. Like Mexico City in the 1930s had a population of 500 million, and they just weren't growing enough food, especially wheat, because they had this big problem with stem rust.
Mm-hmm.
And stem rust is this particle that floats through the air. Like there's nothing you can do to stop it, and it'll just kill a lot of your wheat because it attacks it right at the base, so it falls down. So this was going on also like during the Great Depression. And a big problem too was that Mexican cities that were far away from like the main, like the big populous cities, they were growing enough wheat, but it wasn't viable to take their wheat and just send it to the big cities, because then you're just producing more famine amongst your smaller rural communities.
Mm-hmm.
So the Rockefeller Foundation pulls up. And they're like, yeah, we're going to help you out, Mexico. And they enlisted the help of Norman Borlaug. Norman Borlaug was a cool dude. Like, he spent so much time trying to crossbreed a plant that was immune to stem rust. Like he would literally go out every day and have these plants and he would pollinate them himself and put them in a bag so the stem rust wouldn't affect them. And he would do that with like every single plant. And half the time, a lot of them would die because of stem rust, but he eventually was able to create a wheat that yielded the most, that was immune to stem rust, and that had the strength to like stand up on its own and not fall over due to wind or anything. So it's not really related to churro, but I wanted to do the churros because flour is like a main ingredient in them. And they probably weren't making a lot of them, especially when they're going through shortages of food, especially shortages of wheat. And because it ties into the Great Depression, and our next one ties into the Great Depression, so it follows the theme. But yeah, that's the churros history. Any of you had a churro?
Yeah, they're good.
I love churros.
I always thought they were like they came from Mexico. So that's really interesting. Yeah, it's just the most popular like version of it.
Yeah.
You had a Mexican churro, Nina?
Yeah, when I went to Mexico, I had a churro.
Mm-hmm. Very good, very good.
Yeah. Did it have anything inside of it?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I've never seen that before.
Yeah, I didn't know they had things. So I could get them.
Yeah, I found a recipe. I don't want to go to it, but I could. It's like really. It's like, okay, I lost the recipe, but I had a recipe and it involved like stuffing it with like cream.
Ooh, like cream, like cheese, I think.
Yeah. Or chocolate. I know you don't like chocolate.
Not that.
Okay, so for the last part, I'm going to talk about the interview I did with my great grandma. She's like 96, 97. She's pretty old, but I hope she hasn't listened to this. I care for you, great grandma. All right. So I wanted to ask her a few questions about her childhood, especially relating to dessert. The questions I wanted to ask were, do you remember having any desserts? Was there a special one? If there was a special one, how was it made? What did it mean to you to get dessert? How much was everyone in the house working at the time? What type of jobs did you specifically have? Was mealtime a big deal for your family? And were there any ingredients that were hard to come by? So I actually learned a lot from my great-grandma. She told me a bunch of stuff about that and stuff about my family that we don't have to get into. But like, she told me some crazy stuff. The two desserts that she really wanted to highlight were angel food cake and homemade ice cream. So she said the angel food cake was a special dessert that they would have, but not everybody liked it. So they're making a lot more ice cream. And just to give you like background, she grew up on a farm and they had 25 to 30 dairy cows every year. They had a couple hundred hogs. They had about 500 hens because my great grandma's mom, so my great great grandma, would buy 500 eggs like every year and try and hatch as many as she could, because they owned a produce store in the town that they used to live by, Des Moines, Iowa. Mm-hmm. So they owned a produce store during the Great Depression, and that's where they got a lot of their money, because during the Great Depression, people just like farmers were being very underpaid, so they were refusing to give out food, and that was a big problem with the Great Depression, was nobody could afford to get food anymore because they were just getting rid of it, like dumping it out. But she had a bunch of extra cream at the farm because of the dairy cows. And so every day she would wake up at like 4 a.m. and go make ice cream, and they would sell that at their store too. They also grew a lot of crop like corn, tomatoes, potatoes, a bunch of different fruits. But she would make that ice cream every day. It involved taking a bunch of ice that she'd have to chip and putting it in this like machine. And then she said that she would use more cream than you're supposed to and use less milk because they just always had extra cream. Mm-hmm. And then you basically like close it and just like crank it with your hand for a while and then pull it all out. Yeah,
like my granddad, he still makes like homemade ice cream and it's so good. Like seeing him make it for the first time when I was younger was interesting. So like you said, like he just like would crank it for so long, like I did it one time, but yeah, it's so good. It's so much better than like regular ice cream.
Mm-hmm. I've never had homemade ice cream.
Really?
It's so good.
Dad makes some good homemade ice cream. It's always like a family comes over, like Christmas or Thanksgiving. It's like I'm pulling out the ice cream maker.
Like, I didn't really know, like, other families did that. Like, I thought it was, like, my granddad kind of thing.
No, I, like, I did not know that she made ice cream. She's never made it for us. She always makes these things called monster cookies. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, these giant cookies that are oatmeal. And it's got, like, a bunch of peanut M&Ms in it and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's really
good.
Oh, yeah. You know what I'm talking about? The monster cookies. I'd kill for a monster cookie right now. They're so good. Anyways, this produce store was giving them a lot of money during the Depression. And the way the family dynamic broke down, she had like four brothers, I think. She was the oldest. All of her brothers and her dad would go out and work with the animals and with like the bigger crops, like they're tend to the fields, you know. And then her and her mom would collect eggs in the morning and take them to the store to sell. They would collect fruits from the garden. And then another thing was like my great-great-grandma was like a canner. So like, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
She would can literally 1,000 jars a year. Like that was like her thing. And my great-grandma never got into canning because like freezing units, like refrigeration units came out about 70 years ago. And so she just started filling up freezers with food. Like literally every time I've been to her house, it's like seven different freezers just filled with food and always filled with food.
What like specifically your great-great-grandma can?
She would can mostly like fruits, like pears and apples and stuff. But she would also can a lot of stuff like carrots or I just got to find it real quick. Raspberries, tomatoes, corn. Pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. Like if they could eat it at a later time and she could can it, she would can it. And they would just save that for the winter.
It's definitely an interesting way to grow up, like during all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it was interesting because like the high school that she went to, a lot of kids, especially in Iowa at that time, since they were all farmers, would just be done with school after eighth grade. Mm-hmm. And there was only one high school in like the entire county that she lived in Dallas County. And that's where like all the kids went. And so she would have to walk there from her house every day. It was like 2 miles or something. But
dang,
that sounds awful to me.
Yeah.
Like I don't even like walking to school now.
Like literally walking to class from across campus.
Not having it. They would also make a lot of pie. A lot of fruit pies. But I thought it was interesting to include because she was a child during, like, she was like 9 when the Great Depression was like peaking. So I kind of figured she'd be like struggling more and having more issues. But it was more like she was living the farm life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like people who lived on farms during the Depression, I mean, I know they weren't getting paid. And it was, there was a whole lot of different types of struggles that they had. But my great-grandma, she also lived on a farm during the Depression. I remember I asked her once and she said like it wasn't awful, it was definitely weird times, but they were usually able to at least have food on the table most days, which is interesting. And yeah, and just all the different types of things they did to save food and stuff like that.
Now she's definitely like a hoarder when it comes to food. All right, y'all got any other questions or comments about anything?
I was going to say, back when you were talking about how World War I popularized the donut, like, and, like, how after the war that became very popular, probably maybe, like, also had something to do with the, like, war rationing and how people couldn't necessarily eat, like, I think sugar and, like, there's lots of things that were rationed. And then how that, when that ended, people were probably very excited to have donuts.
Sugar crazy,
exactly. Yeah. Definitely helped popularize it, I'm sure.
Yeah, back to the donut fossils. Were they like actual donut fossils or just things shaped like donuts?
I believe what I read was that the archaeologists were finding things that looked both like donuts and they found things that looked like they could be used to make donuts. Because they weren't like finding food, obviously, because it was like fossilized. But they were in like the old settlements finding stuff that they were like, a donut, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, the donut's interesting too, because like the person like credited with like coming up with the idea was a ship captain's mother. And the reason she made donuts was because you could put like figs and stuff, like things that could provide you nutrients so you don't get scurvy inside the donut and it would last longer. But she never put the hole in it. Her son put the hole in it so he could skimp out on rations a little and save a little, you know? Mm-hmm. So he always was like, he was always like, I'm the one that put the hole in it. But like, it's his mom that came up with the idea.
You just want to skimp out on people.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Like, you know, like how the donut used to be like, before everybody could get them, how they used to be like a delicacy. I wonder if like, what they would do with the holes.
I was like, give us
linking
that.
Like, give us link.
Well, that's.
Or they just take the dough and make it into more.
Well, donuts. When you make a donut, you wrap it around something so you don't take anything out of it.
So donut holes don't actually come from the middle of the donut.
No, a donut hole. A donut hole is something completely separate. What? Like you make donut holes separate from the donut. You don't actually.
Ruined my whole prediction of donut project. Yeah, you just made me so stupid.
I swear, you don't actually.
I was really thinking the same thing though, because I was like, they didn't use to sell donut holes to make donut holes.
Like, you're not gonna give them to the poor people. Like,
no,
oh my god,
donut holes came way later.
I'm so mad.
Because people always thought, like, where do you put the donut hole? Like, you got
no way. But no,
the way you make a donut is by like wrapping it around something.
I feel so stupid.
I feel stupid too.
You should. I feel like I've known that since I was like 12.
Okay, chill out, man.
It's called a donut hole.
It literally called a donut hole, and there's a donut with
it. It don't even fit inside the donut.
I've never tried.
Yes, I've tried.
Well, that's when you're not.
Right. I know they definitely make them that way.
They absolutely
do. They do not cut a hole in
the donut. They make them a dough and then they like cut off the hole, then you have a donut shape. If they don't do that, they should do
it
now.
I'm pretty sure when like, okay, I was probably like 8 or 9. This lady in my neighborhood would always make donuts. And we went over there one day and that's how we did them. Like we literally had a whole
look at that first-hand experience. Looks like you're
like, I'll show y'all right now how to make a donut, and y'all will feel foolish.
Hot to make a donut? I don't think that's right either.
It's hard to tie from this angle.
Just go to the first one. Go to the first one.
Yeah, that one looks like it definitely.
Making them is easy.
I want donuts now.
Don't make me ask Alexa.
Look, you
wait,
see
the
up
cutter
up.
Thing? That is a
you
cutter.
Don't put a hole in it. I'm why telling you.
Why does it say it? Why is there
show me a YouTube video?
What? Cutter. Why would it have these in it then?
Well, then what's that for?
I don't know. Breaking an egg.
Why would you break an egg with that? Okay, look at the directions.
Okay. You mix the dough together. You roll them and you cut them into donuts using a donut cutter.
Okay. And then you cut a hole in the middle.
No, that's what happens. Like you're cutting.
You don't cut.
Oh! Oh, that's a hole. That's a hole.
I'm talking about historically. I read something last night that was
really
like,
historically.
Oh yeah, I do need to cite my sources.
Yeah, you do need to cite.
My sources for this project were "Sweet Invention: The History of Dessert" by Michael Crandall. "Sweetness and Power" by Sidney Mintz. "Mexico's Way Out" by Colather. Saltandwind.com for the churro. And "Cambodian Donut Shops and the Negotiation of Identity in Los Angeles." And "The History of the Donut," Smithsonian Magazine. And my great grandma. Those are my sources.
You got a name?
Kareen Martin.
You look like you didn't really know that.
I always forget her name.
I don't care.
Why am I supposed to know her name?
You don't call her grandma.
She's been great grandma to me since I've known her.
You don't call her, like, I always call my grandma, like, Grandma Joyce or Grandma.
I literally don't remember the last time I said my great grandma's name. I think that was, like, I think it was a long time
ago. I still know them, though.
Yeah, I know them. My great grandpa's name was Dale. R.I.P. Yeah, anything else? Any other questions you might have about any of these desserts? or anything I've talked about.
Do you have any donuts for us to sample?
Yes, I do. Right here.
Hey, wait, let me make the donut hole.
I had some really good donuts yesterday, actually, from Tim's Bakery in McCordsville, Indiana.
All right. Sorry for that little cut off there at the end. But I just want to thank Katie, Cheyenne, and Nina for joining me on the History of Dessert podcast. And if you're listening, I hope you learned something. I hope you enjoyed. And that will conclude the History of Dessert Global History of Food podcast. Thank you for joining.